All right, tonight we're in Genesis chapter 37. And as we go back very rapidly, we can pick up our story in this way, that as we start in Genesis 1:1 down to what is our magic verse, in chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, there's the one of the promise to Abraham. This tells us about the beginning of mankind and how man had rejected God over and over and over and over again. And so God now is going to call Abraham so that he can bring the seed in. So then we have Abraham, and Abraham begat whom? Isaac. Isaac begat whom? Jacob. Jacob begat whom? The 12. All right, here then, we have these 12 men, and as we have looked at them, even though we have seen that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have been men of high quality, and you might question some of Jacob's activity, but I would caution you before you say anything to remember that when Jesus was on earth, he said that many shall rise and enter into the kingdom with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So I know where Jacob is. Jacob went to heaven. So we have these three individuals, high-quality men. We get down now to these 12. And what are we finding out about the characteristic of these leaders, these 12 patriarchs? Have they done some very shameful things? All right, up to now we have seen that some of them have done some very shameful things. However, that is not our story tonight. Our story now tonight is to pick up with one of these individuals, and the one that we're going to be picking up on is Joseph. Now, before we look at Joseph, as I put the arrow down here, and as we come on down, and we're going to come down to Christ, that's the very purpose of this whole line. Who's going to be the individual that we would follow out of here, out of all of these men, out of these 12? Who's going to be the one? All right, Judah. Jesus Christ is going to come from the lineage of Judah. And so as we pick up the story of Joseph now, he's going to be a very important man. However, he's not in the lineage of Jesus Christ. Now, as we have emphasized over and over and over again, the only reason any of these people have any importance at all, the only reason that Abraham is a famous man, the only reason that his name is known in this generation, there's not another reason other than you look down there and it is Jesus Christ. It was to bring Christ into existence. All right, we have the arrow then going down, shooting straight down here to Jesus Christ. That is where we're going to come. We'll have some other individuals in there, but we're headed down to Jesus Christ. But right now, we're going to stop and we're going to take a look now at Joseph right here now. And as we stop to look at him, why is he going to be important? He's not in the lineage of Christ. And here it is. I told you way back then, when I ask you any question, you can answer it with one word. What is the word? Christ. Why is Joseph important? Christ. That's right. That's the answer. Because of Christ. But not because he is in the lineage of Christ. Now, here is the reason Joseph is going to be an important individual. And that is that Joseph is going to do something that will preserve these 12 men, and one of these fellows is Judah, you see. And so as we put all of these guys in there, here is Judah at this time, very insignificant, unimportant, and I might say, not a very nice individual. So here they are. Now, unless Joseph does something, all of these guys are going to be wiped out. Now, what's going to happen if all of a sudden something happens and we wipe all of these guys out? There's not going to be any Judah. There's not going to be anybody to carry on the line for the seed down there. Now, how important is it then? How important is it going to be for Joseph to do whatever he has to do in order to preserve these 12 patriarchs, keep them alive so that they can have children and they can have children so that Christ can come into existence? How important is that going to be? I guess it would be kind of like if President Reagan was going to meet with the leader of Russia again. He has to be there at 10 o'clock in the morning, or a war is going to break out. They're going to punch a button, and a nuclear war is going to break out. He's in his limousine going down the street, and all of a sudden it dies. How important is a mechanic at that time? Now, all of a sudden, whose attention would the news media be on? It dies. A mechanic is out. It's 9:30. He has to be there at 10 o'clock. The mechanic goes out and jumps under the hood. Where are all the cameras going to be? They're going to be on the mechanic, aren't they? And that's who they're interested in. That's who they're going to interview. How good is the mechanic? Can he fix it? Is he able? Mechanic, 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 everything. But once the car is purring again, what about that mechanic? Totally insignificant now. He goes away because the important thing is the president meeting with the Russian leader. Now that's what Joseph is. Joseph is a very important figure because he's going to be an individual that God will use to preserve the nation of Israel. And so, when we ask then, as we're studying now tonight about the story of Joseph, I want us to keep in mind, even though he's not in the lineage, he is important, and the reason he's important is the same reason Abraham is important, same reason any of them is, Jesus Christ. He is the answer to every question that you find as you're studying your Bible. All right. Now, since he's going to be so important, there's going to be a large section devoted to Joseph. And the reason that this large section is devoted to Joseph is to show us what he did, which is going to be to save the nation. And it's going to show us how he went about saving the nation. Now, in this, we can learn many, many lessons. But after we have learned all of the lessons, keep in mind there's one purpose for having this story in the Bible. You could take chapter 37, go over to the rest of Genesis, get it there, rip it out of your Bible, throw it away. You see, if it wasn't for one thing, it's preserving the lineage of Jesus Christ. That's the main thing. That's the purpose it's in there for. Now, in this, we'll learn a lot of other things. But I want you to keep in mind, that's the reason this section is in your Bible, is to show us how that lineage was preserved. Okay, now we go back to chapter 37, and we will not be able to cover a whole lot of territory tonight, because we're going to lay the groundwork on Joseph. Everybody knows the story about Joseph and his coat of many colors. But as we began looking here, it says here that Jacob now is dwelling there in his father's sojournings, and then it tells us that Joseph was, in verse 2, how old was he? 17. Now that's only interesting right now. It'll become a little more important a little bit later on. Right now it's just an interesting thing. He's just a young kid getting ready to go do a job. But remember how old he was. Now, he's 17, and his brothers were older than what he was. And he was out one day with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, and they did something they shouldn't have done. And he goes and tells Daddy on it. Here we have a little tattletale. He runs in and he tells Daddy what they did. And they got in trouble. Now, how do you suppose they feel about it? Their little tattletale brother. Now, how many families have we found that have had problems, family problems? Everyone so far. Now, Abraham, his story is not in the Bible to teach us about family problems, is it? But did Abraham have family problems? Did he have a heart broken over and over and over again? Yes, you see, because of his family. Isaac and Jacob, really the same way. Now, here we have Jacob, and Jacob has some family problems. Among these 12 boys, there is a great deal of hatred. So, here this young boy comes in, and he's a little tattletale. Now, what about Jacob? What do we call him? In today's nomenclature, when he was a kid. Jacob and Esau. Who's the real man? He-man. Esau, who's the mama's boy. he was a little sissy. He was mama's boy. And that caused a great deal of problems. Now we have a little tattletale, and it's Joseph. And he comes in and he tells on his brothers. Now, am I saying he shouldn't have told on his brothers? I don't want you to misunderstand me. Is there ever a time when you should tell on somebody? When a brother said, "Why, surely you should." I don't know what the boys did, and probably it is the best that he did tell his dad. But all I'm saying is, what happens when you have 11 brothers and you go and tell on a bunch of them? I don't care whether you deserve it or not, and the meaner they are, the more trouble you're going to be in. I just want you to see, here is a normal, everyday American family with a lot of problems within that family. Okay, now verse 3, it said, now Israel, now who's Israel? Jacob, okay. Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age and he made him a coat of many colors. All right, now here's two big mistakes right here. Here is a dad that loved this one boy more than he loved the others. And could the other boys perceive it? Could they understand it? Yeah, they understand this. And he then did him a favor that he didn't do to the other boys. He made him a coat of many colors. Evidently, this is a very fancy coat, a very nice coat, a very special thing, something that he didn't do for his other boys. And so his boys knows Daddy is now showing favoritism. Now, what's that going to do? The boys are mad at Joseph, and now how do they feel about Dad? They're upset at Dad now. See, there's a lot of family problems in here. All right, in verse 4, and his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, and they hated him, and could not speak peaceably unto him. Now, that's an awfully easy thing to write, isn't it? But how many of you have had kids that couldn't speak peacefully one to the other? They were always bickering, fighting. I know nobody in here had, but how many of you have ever seen anybody else that had kids like this? See, brothers and sisters, they fight all the time. You ball them out, you just almost choke them and put them back in the bedroom, and they'll look over there and stick their tongue out at one another. You know, and that's what is going on here. They cannot leave him alone. And you can imagine what 11 brothers could cause, how much trouble 11 older brothers could cause a younger brother. Joseph is a boy with a lot of problems. Now, to add to these problems, Joseph has a dream. Now, here obviously is where some miraculous element is coming into this. Joseph has a dream, and he told his brothers about the dream, and what did that cause them to do? In verse 5, they hated him yet the more. It caused them to hate him more. Well, here's the dream. I'm going to tell it without reading it. He dreamed that there were all of these sheaves that are out there. Now, what a sheave is if you go out in hay, let's suppose that you have some hay that's up this high. What you do is that you take a knife and you go and you cut the hay and you catch it in your arms. You catch it in your arms as it's falling. And when you get a big bundle of hay like this, then you tie a string around it. And so you have this string and you can carry your hay around. That's a sheave. That really is what it is. Now, this was an everyday affair to those farmers out there. And so Joseph said, each one of us had a sheaf, and your little shock of hay came over and bowed down to mine. All of you. So I don't know what it means, but that's what I dreamed. Now, that really made them mad. You little egotistical knothead, you. And they hated him yet the more. Then he had another dream. And the next dream was that there were down here in where it is. Well, they came and they said, does that mean, do you think you're going to have domination over us in verse 8? And then in verse 9, he dreamed another one. And what it was, he said, behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars came and did obeyance to me. Last night I was dreaming, and the moon and the star, and moon and sun and 11 stars came over, and they all bowed down in front of me like this. And that really got his brothers upset, and it even upset his dad and his mom. And so his dad then bawled him out and said, do you think that your dad and mom is going to bow themselves down to you with all the brothers? Joseph, it's time for you to straighten yourself up, buddy. In other words, you can imagine in the rebuke, you thinking too highly of yourself and so forth. So it said his father rebuked him in verse 10. Then in verse 11, and his brothers envied him, but his father kept saying in mind. So his brothers, they envied that relationship that he had with his dad and envied his confidence, I guess, and these things that were happening, but they didn't like it at all. Now then, in verse 12, his brothers went up to Shechem feed sheep. So they took the herds of sheep up there. So let's now see where Shechem is. As we look here, right down here, Jerusalem is 19 miles over from the Dead Sea. And as you go up here, 13 miles, here is Bethel. So right there is where they're living at this time. They're living right here. Now then, you come up here, and right up here is Shechem. So I'll hold both of them there. So as you go up, there it is, and it would be about 20 miles is what it would be from where they live to where the boys have the sheep up there. So his dad told him one day, he said, I haven't heard from the boys, and so why don't you go now and see how they're doing, and then you come back and tell me how those boys are doing. So he takes off. He gets up there where they're herding the sheep, and they're not there. And so he's walking around. He knows where he is. He's walking around the fields looking for them. And finally a man comes along and says, son, are you lost? What are you looking for? And he said, I'm looking for my brothers. They're up here herding sheep. Have you seen them? He said, yes. He said, your brothers are up here at Dothan. Now, what he did is, Dothan is right on up in here then. Here's Shechem, and Dothan in fact, it's not on this map, but it's right in here. And so they moved up about another 20 miles up here. And said they're up there. So he leaves, and he goes up there, and sure enough, he finds his brethren up there at Dothan then. Now, when they see him coming, it's 40 miles away from Daddy. Verse 18, and they saw him afar off, and before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. They're going to kill him. And they said one to another, behold, this dreamer cometh. The idea behind that dreamer is this master of dreams. The man who thinks that he has this mastery, you see, of these dreams. This dreamer cometh. Come now and let us slay him and cast him into one of the pits. And we will say, we'll go back and tell Dad, an evil beast hath devoured him. And we shall see what will become of his dreams then. After we kill him, we'll see what happens to his dreams. Now, that's what these boys were going to do. Now, the picture that we get of these 12 boys so far is not really high moral principled guys, are they? Going to kill their brother. But now Reuben doesn't want to do this. Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not take his life. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but lay no hand upon him, and he said this, that he might deliver him out of their hands to restore him to his father. So what Reuben says is, let's just scare the kid to death. Let's throw him in the pit, and he can't get out, and we'll leave him. How would you like to be left out there in a wilderness, in a field, nobody around, and here's a sheer pit that you can't get out of, and throw you in there and say bye, and we walk away. And you're in there yelling until somebody comes along, if they do come along before you die. So he said, that'll teach him a lesson. Let's just throw him in there and leave him, and then we'll go. What Reuben intended to do was, after they left, come back around, get him out of the pit, and tell him to get back home to his dad. So they then threw him in there, and they stripped his coat off and put him in it. There was no water in there. And then they sat down to eat some bread. Verse 25. They sat down to eat their dinner then to determine what it was going to do. Now, as they did that, they looked up and they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing these various things. And they were going down to Egypt. So what these Ishmaelites were doing is that they were coming from up in here. They were headed down in here, and Egypt is right down in here on the map. So they were headed down through here. So they looked up and they saw these Ishmaelites. Now we know who the Ishmaelites are now, don't we? They're from Ishmael. Who's Ishmael's father? Abraham, right. So here they come, and then Judah wants to save him also. So in verse 26, Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our flesh. And his brother hearkened unto him, and there passed by Midianites. Now, that's the same group. The Ishmaelites are called Midianites, and they evidently, these are Ishmaelites by genealogy, and they live in the country of the Midianites, is about the only way that I would know to explain what that is talking about here. So it says they took the Midianites, and by the way, do you know who Midian's daddy was? Hey, I started to say I'd give you $100 if you know, and she'd have won it back there, wouldn't she? We didn't cover it in here. Somebody has been studying their Bible a little too closely. It was Abraham. Now, can you figure that one out? That impresses me. Back in, where is chapter 24? I think it is, where Abraham remarried. Chapter 25. Where Abraham remarried, if you look down there, he took then another wife, and then she bare him. And as you look, a boy down there by the name of Medan and Midian. And so there's two of them, but there's where Midian comes from. Is from Abraham. So that's the nation that there is, and these people then are living up in that area. Now, they then call over to say, hey, we've got this slave boy over here, we'll sell him to you. So they sold Joseph in verse 28 to the Midianites then for 20 pieces of silver. They then dispersed, went their way, had their 20 pieces of silver. They take Joseph, away they go. Reuben is not there. He's out with his sheep somewhere when all this transpires. Then he comes back and runs over the hole, and Joseph is not in the hole. And of course, that really then shakes him up. He runs to his brethren and he says, "Where is the boy?" And so forth. And he is really upset. So they then, in verse 31, took Joseph's coat and killed a he-goat and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their fathers and said, "This we have found. Know not whether it is thy son's coat or not." And he knew it and said, "It is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn in pieces." Now, I want you to keep this in mind, because I'm going to make a big play on something later on, and it's going to show us a very, very important lesson. But right now, what I want you to see is this, that these boys came back. They took the coat, dipped it in blood, came back, deceived their dad. They said, do you recognize this coat? Could this possibly be the one you got for Joseph? And he recognized it, yes, has blood all over. And then he believed that lie. He believed the lie. And when he believed the lie, he believed that he was torn by an evil beast. What happened to him? See, what happened to him? I want you to note this. Where is Joseph right now? He's on his way down to Egypt. He's in good health. But his dad believes he's dead. What would happen to you right now if somebody came in and stopped class and said, "Lowell, excuse me," and called your name, said, "So-and-so here. You went out here. There's a policeman out here and says, your wife, your husband, a child, just got killed in an accident." How would you feel? Now, let's suppose that it's just a practical joke. It's just a prank. How would you feel when you're out here in the hallway? Would it be any different than if they were actually killed? No. All right, now keep that in mind. Here is where he is deceived, and so here now is what he does. And Jacob rent his garment and put sackcloth upon his loins. That's showing what an agonizing spirit he was in. And mourned for his son many days. There he's going through what we call grief and what the Bible calls grief. The Bible uses two words, grief and mourning. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted. Can you relate to that with a person in grief? You see when they're there? Why did he refuse to be comforted, by the way? Everybody tried to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. When Doris died, many of you tried to comfort me, but I refused your comfort. And you saw me after you talked with me. Some of you took me out to dinner. Some of you come by and talk with me. The pals several times came by the office, and we'd go out and you'd try to comfort me, but the next day you'd find me in the same case. Why did he refuse to be comforted?
Well, it's something he loved pretty much.
That's right. He couldn't help it. See, he's going through this. It's not as though he was stubborn. And they came and said, "We're sorry." And he said, "Oh, okay. If you're sorry, then that's all right. You know, my son's dead, so then I'll get on about my business." Just trying to point that out, that as we read the Bible a lot of times, we read it very rapidly, and we don't put it in everyday life the way it actually happens. And that's the thing that it's talking about here. He just couldn't be comforted. And he said, "For I will go down to Sheol, which is my grave, to my son's mourning. This death is going to kill me." That's what he said. And his father wept for him. And the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's, the captain of the guard. So he took him down, sold him as a slave to a guy by the name of Potiphar. He had a high office in the Pharaoh's army. He was the chief over the guard out there. Mm-hmm.
Do you suppose that the brothers told him that Joseph had been killed, or just implied it?
I think he implied it.
Because it doesn't say one way or the other.
No.
I wonder if he just walked in with a coat with the blood all over it.
I think that's what they did. They had it all there, and we found this coat out here, you see, and here it is all messed up, and you recognize it, and yeah, and well, there it is. It's you see, and so they definitely implied it and led him to believe that he was dead. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, back where Reuben was involved in that, and it seems like it was important to him, you know, that he didn't die or whatever.
Right.
And why would he,
I can't answer that.
Go along with that?
That's a good question. I can't answer it. Reuben, back in verse 21, did not want his dad to go through all of this suffering. But when it happened, he permitted him to go through it all. And he didn't tell it. Now, of course, when you put it in real life, did Reuben have any peer pressure? What would have happened to him in the family had he gone in and said, "Dad, I want you to know," and then told the truth? What would have happened to all his brothers? He would have been ostracized and perhaps even been killed next. See, these are guys that are playing for keeps in here. Mm-hmm.
They could have seen Reuben too. It doesn't really indicate.
Well,
that. Why?
That's a possibility. That's a good point. They ever hadn't thought about that. Let's see. "And Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. He returned to his brethren and said, 'The child is not, and whether shall I go?' And they took Joseph's coat." You're right. It doesn't say that they told Reuben the truth. However, I think down at the end of the whole story, it's going to imply that they were all in on it. That they knew it in there. Okay. Chapter 38. Now, in the midst of all of this, we're going to see that life goes on as usual. Now, certain things happen. "And it came to pass at that dad is in this terrible state of mourning, that Judah went down from his brethren and turned in to a certain Adullamite." Now that is a man there, whose name was Hiram. "And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua." Now I might point out to you right now that the daughter's name is not Shua. It's the Canaanite is Shua, and the daughter is going to be something else. See, in there. So the Canaanite now is by the name of Shua, and he has a daughter. All right, now he took her and went into her, and she conceived and bare a son, and he called his name Ur. And she conceived again and bare a son, and she called his name Onan. And she yet again bare a son and called his name Sheba. And he was at it and so forth. So I look at verse 6. "And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar." Now, start keeping this in mind. What we have here is Judah went out and got married. And Judah and his wife had some kids. Now, there's the name of the kids. And one of them was Ur, and one of them was Onan. Now, look in verse 7. "And Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of Jehovah, and Jehovah slew him." We still having family problems? Yeah, wicked there and there. And he was so wicked, God took his life. "And Judah said unto Onan, 'Go in unto thy brother's wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her, and raise up seed to thy brother.'" Now, here we come to a certain law that we have to be familiar with. And it's really called the Levirate law a little bit later on. But now notice in verse 9, "And Onan knew that the seed would not be his, So now let's stop right there. Before you go any farther and form any false impressions, let's stop right here and try to set a stage. Something is going to happen right here that many, many people get the wrong idea about. You'll hear that the world today, the Catholic Church and many people, going to use this passage right in here to prove some false things. Now, here is the situation. That according to Deuteronomy, the 25th chapter, verses 5 through 10, Deuteronomy 25. Now, by the way, I know I'm giving you Deuteronomy. That's way on down the line, isn't it? See? It's way on down the line. All right, this law is incorporated within the law of Moses. That's how we know it. But it was in existence back here. In other words, this is the beginning of this thing back here. Now, here's what the law was. That when a person gets married, and if that man dies before he has any children, then his next of kin, his brother, has the responsibility of going into that woman and conceiving a child by that woman. That woman then will give birth. And then that child will not belong to the man who conceived it. Belong to the man who died. Everybody got the picture? See? In other words, the man who died doesn't have anybody to carry on his lineage. So his brother has the responsibility going to the widow and conceiving a child by her. When she has the child, it'll not belong to this fella who conceived it at all. It will belong to the dead husband and carry on his name and carry on his lineage. Now, that's what has happened. That here is that Ur got killed, didn't have any children. So Judah goes to him, to Onan, the next, and says, "Now, son, you go in to the wife and you conceive a child so that Ur will have this lineage to carry it on." Now, before we go any farther, let me do this. Let me ask you this. Let me give you an illustration. Suppose that I sell Larry. No, suppose I buy Larry's car. I buy it tonight in front of all of you. And I promise him I'll give you $1,000 down. So Larry said, "Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll sell it to you for $1,000 down. And I'll give you a good deal, you know, $100 a month. And then for so long. And you can have that car." "Okay." We shake hands. I take out my checkbook. I write $1,000 for him. I take his car. Away I go. Tomorrow at 10 o'clock, I go down to the bank and put stop payment on that check. Is that right or wrong? Well, okay, what does it depend on?
I've seen Larry's car.
Well, he's selling me his Mercedes. I just bought his Mercedes. I'm down there at 10 o'clock in the morning. I put a stop payment on that. Nothing wrong with the car. Happy with the car.
It's wrong.
In fact, I'm taking off the Spokane. It's wrong, isn't it? You'd say, that is wrong for you to stop payment. That's the same as not paying him what you said you would pay him. That's wrong. Okay, now I'm going to ask you a question. Is it wrong to put a stop payment on a check?
Not in itself.
No, that's not wrong to put a stop payment on a check. There may be circumstances in which I should put a stop payment on a check. And so, just because you can find one incident of where I put a stop payment on check, and I'm wrong, just as wrong as I can be, you can't then jump to the conclusion it's wrong to put a stop payment on check. Now you see why I'm giving you this illustration in just a moment. Let's see what Onan did. It said that he knew that the seed would not be his, and it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he spilled it on the ground lest he should give seed to his brother. And the thing which he did was evil in the sight of Jehovah, and he slew him also. Now here's a man that did a very evil thing. Very evil. He went in and had sexual relations with this woman. Now I'm asking, was it wrong? Was that wrong for him to have sexual relations with her?
No.
No, that was not fornication. It was not wrong. He had a right to have sexual relations with her. And here, though, that he took action to keep from giving her his seed so that she could conceive. And so, what you say is, here is birth control. And it was. I mean, he was controlling it and saying that we will not have a child from this sexual relationship. And so, he took the action then that is called a form of birth control. Now, here is where then people jump to conclusion and say, you see, the Bible teaches that every time that a man and a woman have sexual relations, that they should never do anything to keep a child from being conceived. No form of birth control. All forms of birth control is wrong. And here was a person practiced a form of birth control. It was evil in the sight of Jehovah, and God slew him. Now, no doubt about what he did was evil. But now I'm going to ask you a question. Did God slay him because he practiced birth control, or did God slay him because he did something else?
He stopped payment on the check.
He stopped payment on the check. That's right. That's the reason I use this. See? No, it says nothing about birth control. He had a responsibility. He had a God-given responsibility to go into that woman, have sexual relations with that woman, and what was the end result? What was the responsibility that he had? If it didn't work today, he'd have to go back and have sexual relations again and again and again. What was his responsibility? To make her conceive. That's right. To bring forth a child. That is his God-given responsibility, to bring forth a child. And he then took the action to keep that child from being born, and he's a very evil man in doing that. See, very evil. Because he stopped payment on the check. Now, is that saying then that all forms of birth control is sinful? When a husband and wife have sexual relations, is it their God-given responsibility to try to conceive a child? Or are there other reasons for sexual relations in the husband-wife relationship? Well, according to 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, what is another reason for husband and wife relationship? Because of having children, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Is that what that says? No. Because of fornication. Right? See? To fulfill the sexual desires so that they'll not be fulfilled in an unlawful act of fornication. And so, husbands and wives are given authority by God to have sexual relations for their own enjoyment, to bring them together as one flesh, to fulfill their sexual desires one toward another. That is authorized by God. And now, what if God said, as he did to Onan, what if he said, every husband and wife is to, every time they go in to each other, it's for the purpose of having children? Then what about birth control? Then birth control would be wrong. All that I'm saying is, this passage right here is totally taken out of its context, totally misused in showing and trying to show that a birth control is a sin. All right, everybody see that? Okay. Now then, this lady then has not been given any seed. She hadn't been given any children. Now then, as we go down in verse 12, it says, in the process of time, Shua's daughter, now the wife of Judah, died. So now Judah loses his wife. And Judah was comforted and went up. That means he went through the grief process, and finally he was comforted. And when he did that, he went up to his sheep herders, to Tinah, to his friend Hira, the Adullamite there. The same guy going up before there. And it was told Tamar, saying, now who's Tamar? That's the daughter-in-law that Onan did that terrible thing to, see, that didn't go in and give her that child. And it was told Tamar, saying, behold, thy father-in-law goeth up to Tinah to shear his sheep. And she put off from her garments of her widowhood, and covered herself with her veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in the gate of Enaim, which is by the way to Timah, for she saw that Shelah was growing up, and she was not given unto him to wife. Now, who would Shelah be? That's the other son. Judah did not go and get his other son and say, you go in to her. Any reason why he might not have? He should have. I'm not justifying him. He should have. Any reason why he might not have?
He already lost two sons.
He's already lost two sons, you see, in this situation. And it is maybe he didn't know what happened with old man, too, right? You see? And so he's holding this younger son back. So she sees now that the younger son is growing up where he can father children, and yet Judah hasn't taken any steps to have her to conceive. So it said, verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot, for she had covered her face. So there was a sign of the harlotry. And he turned unto her by the way and said, come, I pray thee, let me come unto thee. For he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. Now, of course, the question might be right in here, and it's a legitimate question. Why would she have thought about this plan to start with? Why would a daughter-in-law think about this plan, hear that father-in-law is taking a trip, and so she runs and gets in front of him and dresses up as a prostitute so she can have relations with him? Yeah, to have a child, but would that come to your mind? I mean, with your father-in-law? What does she know about Judah? The point I'm getting at is, what does she know about his character?
He must have a reputation.
He must have a reputation. Yeah, see, this must be something that is rather normal with him. And I think we'll see that is that's the truth as the story goes on. So she knew what he did when he went out. And so she now is wanting to have a child. So he comes and he makes her the proposition. Can I come in to you? And so, as a good prostitute, she makes a deal. She said, what do you give me? And he said, well, I will... and he said, I will send thee a kid of the goats from the flock. And so she said, well, all right, I'll take that. Will you give me a pledge till thou send it? Now, what's that? Will you give me will you give me something to hold until you send the kid? In other words, what you got? A wristwatch or something, you see? And since he didn't have a wristwatch, why, then he said, yeah, I'll give you something here. And so then he said, well, what pledge do I give you? And she said, thy signet and thy cord and thy staff that's in thy hand. Give me your ring, your belt, and your walking staff. You give me those three things, I'll hold them. When you send the kid, I'll give them back to you. He said, good enough. Because he'd gone out to send the kid right back, so it won't be a problem. And so he gave them to her and came in to her, and she conceived by him. And she arose and went away and put off her veil from her and put on the garments of her widowhood. So she just automatically disappeared from the face of the earth. You see, goes back, puts on those garments. And now here is an interesting thing in verse 20. And Judah sent the kid of the goats by the hand of his friend to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, and he found her not. Now, does Judah pay his debts? Yep. Yeah, he's the honest man. He pays his debts. So the guy goes, and he begins to ask. And he asked the men of the place, saying, where's the prostitute that was at Enom by the wayside? And they said, there's been no prostitute here. And he returned to Judah and said, I'm not found her. And also the men of the place said, there's not been any prostitute there. So I went down. I couldn't find her to pay her off. Now, so far right now, this kind of is a shameful thing, isn't it? I mean, that they're involved in, yet there seems to be no shame in here. And I went at the prostitute, and I did this, could you take her down the money? And so, it's just a common, ordinary business deal between these two guys, a rather common thing to do. Now, look at verse 23 of what Judah said in here. And Judah said, let her take it to her, lest we be put to shame. Behold, I sent this kid, and thou hast not found her. Now, what he's saying is, now, I'm calling you as a witness, really. Let it be taken to her. It's her fault. And I want you to witness the fact I tried to pay my debt to the prostitute. And he said, I don't want to do a shameful thing. I don't want to use a prostitute and not pay her what I said I'd owe her. I don't want to do a shameful thing.
Mm-hmm. That was, you know, what kind of question that I would have is what business has he got trying to throw the process through. That'd be my question.
Well, there's your point. See? But that's what I'm getting at. This was something that was an everyday affair with him. I mean, it was something that was a common affair with him and with his friend. And they go down, they're upright businessmen. They pay their debts. What's that? They're honorable. That's the point I'm trying to make here. They're honorable. I mean, they do not use prostitutes without paying them. See? It sounds funny. You see, putting it like that. No, we all see what we're talking about. There's an element in here that's missing. There's something in here that's missing. You see, Larry?
New International Version says a shrine prostitute.
So, that's a good point. This word for prostitute right here really is the word that for a woman who dedicated herself to heathen prostitution and to her god. It wasn't just a common, ordinary, off-the-street prostitute. It was in those days and in the days of Paul. We've made mention of this before. In heathen worship, and any time you have idolatrous heathen worship, somehow or another, they're going to get their immorality in there. Because first of all, to have an idol, you have to make your god. When you make your god, you have to make its laws. And when you make its laws, you make the laws the way you want them. And one of the things that people want is the immorality that's in there. And so they had then these women who would devote themselves to these heathen gods and prostitute themselves in this way. And so this was one of those kind of prostitutes that was giving herself to be used for this god. Now, this could be the reason that they want to pay the debt, because it's on record somewhere there in the temple some way. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems it might be that he looked at himself as a religious person and being mixed up there on the... it seems like they had a problem with having idolatry mixed up with the true religion all along, and that might have been one case.
Well, they did, but at this period of time, it's about the most idolatrous free period that we had. We talked about it last week in there, that this is where they've taken all their idols and they buried them now under an oak tree at this time. And they're not going to intermarry. And they, right back a couple chapters ago, would have nothing to do with these people that's there. It could be somehow. We don't know his mind. I'm merely trying to set the stage so that you see this was a situation that's hard for us to conceive of. That's all I'm getting at. Now, in verse 24, it came to pass after about 3 months that it was told you to say, Tamar, thy daughter-in-law, hath played the harlot. And moreover, behold, she is with child a whoredom. And Judah said, bring her forth and let her be burned. I mean, a woman like that, bring her out, and we're not going to let anything like that happen in this family. We'll burn her. That's pretty harsh punishment, isn't it? You know, it's like stoning. It isn't a real pleasant death. So bring her out, we'll be burned. And when she was brought forth, so they brought her out to burn her, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the man whose these are, am I with child? And she said, discern, or look them over good, is what she says. I pray thee, whose are these? The signet, the cords, and the staff. There they are. She had them in her possession. There's my pay. Now he's caught red-handed. And Judah acknowledged them and said, she is more righteous than I, for as much as I gave her not to Shelah my son. I didn't do what I should have done. This woman, even though she did something that was wrong, she is more righteous than I. It said, and he knew her no more. And it came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in her womb. It came to pass when she travailed that one put out his hand. The midwife took and bound it upon his hand a scarlet thread, saying, this came out first. And it came to pass as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. And she said, wherefore, why hast thou made a breach for thyself? Therefore his name was called Breach. Perez. See? There's always been problems in childbirth and so forth. It's very easy to read that a woman had twins. But what about the woman that had twins? How does she view that? It was quite an ordeal. Anytime that you have a child, that childbirth is quite an ordeal. It takes longer than you just read. Here is a problem type of a birth. And why would they want to know? Now, today, I think this happened. By the way, Linda Quigley just found out this last week that she is having twins. And so she's still in the shock stage. But let's suppose this happened to Linda next April or whenever it is. That one protrudes a hand, pulls back, they put a ribbon around it, and then the other one is born first. Now, which one's firstborn? We're trying to figure out for Linda. Which one's firstborn? Come on, all you wise guys. What's that?
I'd say the one with the ribbon.
The one with the ribbon. All right, you say, would any of you say the one that was born first? If I want to, yeah, there's head shaking. But we got a problem. What have we got? We have a breach. See, we have a debate. We can't decide in this class which one of Linda's babies is the firstborn. Okay, what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about Linda's babies now? We can't decide. Any big deal? What's the big deal?
Inheritance.
What?
Inheritance.
No, Linda's baby.
Well, today's society, there's no big deal.
No, there's no big deal with Linda. We just laugh about it. You see? We just laugh about it. We say, ha, ha, ha. Isn't that something? Yeah, ha, ha, ha. Now the boys will have something to argue about all the days of their life. Who was born? It's a good deal. It's funny. It's no problem. But back there, why was it a breach? Now you hit it, inheritance. See? Now, are these boys going to have problems? We're going to have any family problems? As we go down through there, yeah. So this now is going to cause more problems, and so here's a boy then that is called breach. Okay, as we began in chapter 39, we now are leaving this particular section, and we're going down to Egypt, and we're going to follow Joseph. Now from here on, we're going to pick up Joseph and follow him. Remember, so far he's just been sold down there. We know where he is. But then we went back home and we looked at the brothers back here and the daddy, and there's a lot of problems, a lot of family problems that are going on back there. Right now, in all this mess, Joseph is down in Egypt. What is going on with Joseph? It would be an interesting thing to see what is going on with him all the time that this up here is going. But since we have about 3 minutes, why, it would be pretty hard to cover the next 4, 5, 6 chapters in here. So right here is where we'll close tonight then. So, class dismissed.
Well, I got a question.
Yeah.
On this Levirate marriage thing you were talking about, in one of those marriages, did that union exist only until a child was born, or did you take that woman as your wife for life?
The way I understood it is that it was just for that one, it was just for that one act. And you could take her for your wife, but I don't think that it was an absolute necessity. Yeah. And that's just an opinion that I've got. Now, the reason I would... As you read the law of Moses, it appears it's a one-act situation. But as you read what the Sadducees asked Jesus about, remember, if a brother marries, doesn't bring him, his brother takes him, and 7 brothers, you see, have her. It appears in there, not necessarily so, that it was kind of a wife situation. In other words, in heaven, whose wife is she going to be? See? That's there. But as they give it, he had her, each one of them dies, and it appears that they took her. But, again, you can't figure that out, because if the second one takes her, how long must he live with her before he, if let's suppose he doesn't have to marry her. All he has to do is just conceive a child. How long must he live with her? Until she conceives a child, see? All right, in the Pharisees' example, for some reason or another, this guy lived and he died. This guy lived and he died. And so evidently that they lived as husband and wife all that period of time. See? But again, it's a hypothetical case, so I really can't answer your question. It appears to me it was a one-time situation. Okay. Yeah.
That brings up another question. Now, who is responsible for the support of this wife and this child? And they got to use the limbs that the women could work as... As such in those days,
mm-hmm.
So somebody had to care and feed for them.
Right, somebody would have to do that, and I'm not sure. It doesn't tell who would do it, as far as I know. But it was done by somebody that was in the family, either the brother or the father-in-law. And, of course, this woman would inherit what that boy was going to get. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, last question. Okay.